accession number 18802, reel 28.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 28. I think you were saying that your relations with your departments in Northern Ireland were easier than those of the security and political elements.
Yes, and I think to an extent it was the difference between the subjects covered. I mean, it was easier for my side, but also to an extent it was the way I chose to do business, making quite sure that the Department of Commerce, which was my main point of contact initially, visibly was actually in charge of what it was accustomed to being in charge of, but that it had to keep us informed and involved and so on. And one example of that is that if you take Harlan and Wolff, and this is getting slightly out of kilter with the chronological side of it all, but if you take Harlan and Wolff, which was a direct responsibility of mine, I think because we didn't insist on it running down more quickly to allow for the fact that the order book had more or less dried up and so on, I think that it could be argued that I should have insisted rather more than I did that the Department of Commerce had to run it down rather than take their time over it. But that it's not, I think, an important point in the overall scene. But if I could go back to Harlan and Wolff, and can I just sort of gabble on this thing? The day I arrived in the Northern Ireland office, well, before I arrived, I saw the establishment officer and so on, and he said, we're going to put you somewhere that, he said, you know about security, you know about defence, we're going to put you into something you know nothing about at all, we're going to put you to the industrial desk, and it carried with it a bit of finance and a bit of other things as well. And so I said, well, that sounds very interesting, and so that was all right. And we had to decide whether I was going to go on being a brigadier or whether I'd become a mister. And because the other principals I was going to be alongside could have been my children, if not my grandchildren, we decided mister would be better. And also that'd be easier for dealing with Northern Ireland departments. And so mister I became. And the day I arrived, St. Patrick's Day, 1975, people having said hello and so on, they said, well, now you better get busy quickly, because this evening, Stan Orme, who was the minister responsible for industry, has got a briefing session for a statement in Parliament tomorrow, being Tuesday, I think it was, and oral questions in Parliament on Thursday, both on Harlan and Wolff. And so I said, I really didn't know much about all that. And they said, well, you're responsible for it, for the briefing, including supplementary questions. And being an innocent fellow, I said, what's a supplementary question? And so I was told about that. But fortunately, there was a retired undersecretary who was, as it were, Mr. Harlan and Wolff, because he'd been put in when it was discovered that Harlan and Wolff had lost a lot of money, etc., etc. And he'd been put in, as it were, to take over and organise Harlan and Wolff into some meaningful and eventually profitable sort of arrangement. And fortunately, he'd been around in the Northern Ireland office, I suppose, for about a year by then. And so I stumped along to him and I said, here, I've been told I've got to do all this. Can you tell me what it's all about? And so on. So anyway, he gave me a good briefing. And off I stumped to go and produce paperwork for Stan Orme the following day, and that was all right. And it's a funny way to get introduced to a new job, really.
Thrown in at the deep end.
Throwing in the deep end, and it could have been better. I mean, it was brilliant. I suppose it depends who you are, whether you sort of like it or not. I did like it. And I like to think I took to it quite readily. I like to think that I was a breath of fresh air to the civil servants, and I'm picking up something you were saying earlier on about the civil service. A bit staid, a bit set in its ways in some ways, a bit unwilling to accept responsibility, perhaps, and other ways. Anyway, I like to think that I went in with a completely fresh mind and a completely fresh way of doing business, and that I was actually quite good for the system. And I think that's true because the undersecretary, the establishment officer, produced, after I'd been there a short time, produced a young lady who was a Foreign Office person who wanted to be transferred onto the executive officer side of things, and apparently she was a private secretary, had been a private secretary around about the world for quite a long time. No, not a private secretary, a personal secretary, I'm sorry. And anyway, she was queuing up to become an executive officer. And rather than send her to one of the ensconced civil servants, she was sent to me for training as, you know, turning into an executive officer, which I thought was interesting on the one hand, and a compliment to me and the military system on the other hand. Anyway, that all happened, and she duly got her promotion in due course, and so she was with me, I suppose, about a year. She wasn't all that brilliant, I have to say, but she was adequate. And I had a series of fast stream people after that who came to me just to be executive officers dealing with Harlan and Wolfe on the one hand and Short Brothers and so on the other hand. And one of them, interestingly, who I reported on as an absolute star, I mean a real star, and a potential permanent secretary, who's now he's now chief executive for the Princess Diana Memorial Fund, having passed through being the Archbishop's spokesman at Lambeth Palace, and his name is Andrew Perkis, and I think he's a terrible loss to the civil service. I mean, he's a brilliant young man, and you know, just sad. I say that in passing. Various other young men came along in the fast stream. They were trainees, administrative trainees.
What did you actually do to train them? I mean, it sounds as though it's a sort of apprenticeship scheme, becoming an EO in order to go on into the administrative grades. And did you set them specific exercises, or were they simply doing normal work?
I'm sorry, they didn't become EOs. They became HEOs.
Yes.
On the HEOA, I think they're
yes.
called.
Yes.
And then went off to become principals and things
yes.
in due course. No, I trained them on the job. And mainly, I set them standards. And I set them jobs to do. And I said, I want this one by the day after tomorrow, or whatever. And so they were taught priorities, they were taught detail, they were taught relationships, communication, I mean, all the obvious things that it just came out in training on the job.
Now, you were saying that you found the civil service very different to the army. And how would you compare the two organisations and their methods of work and their way of doing things, ways of doing things?
Well, first of all, I had had dealings with the civil service in the old days, in the War Office, first of all, when I was there in the 1950s, mainly dealing with F1, who were the people for estimates and so on, mainly dealing with them.
Would that be Finance One? Would that
yes,
be the...
Finance One. Mm. And then when I was in the MOD, I had dealings with a couple of DS, defense staff branches, DS5, DS6, which dealt with finance and manpower and so on. And so I'd seen quite a lot of civil servants. The Northern Ireland office, I think one has to remember, it hadn't been going very long. And it was made up of a number of different people. I mean, there was nobody, I think, at that stage who was permanent Northern Ireland office. I think they were all people who'd come from outside.
On secondment.
On secondment, when it was formed. And it was just beginning to get to people who were going to be permanent staff. And I was one of them, because, you know, I didn't come from elsewhere. I was hired to go to the Northern Ireland office. a lot of others, but most of them, I think, were still on the seconded bit. It was, and so Northern Ireland office A was very small, and B was different, and C, I think, probably was more able to be treated as a family than some of the bigger departments. But when I was dealing with Harland and Wolff, I had to deal with the Treasury, I had to deal with the Department of Trade, Department of Industry on shipbuilding, Department of Trade, which was still separate, on shipping as opposed to shipbuilding, and there was some other department we had to deal with, I forget which it was now. But the one I was most concerned with was the Treasury, because we had to clear various plans and projects and so on with them first. And I think my feeling was, you know, I'd been brought up, oh, in the Foreign Office too, I had dealings with a bit, who I regarded as arrogant. But I didn't have much to do with them. But the people I think I was surprised by were the Treasury, because while I'd always understood that the top grade people, applicants to the civil service, went either to the Foreign Office or to the Treasury. And the Treasury people I dealt with, I'm sure the top brass, let's call them, I'm sure they were brilliant. And indeed, I met one or two who were. But an assistant secretary who I had a lot of dealings with, both as a principal and then later on as an assistant secretary myself, I thought, quite honestly, was downright dull on the one hand, and I wasn't at all sure how competent he was on the other hand. Now, I think it's awful for an outside department, a spending department, to have to say that about somebody in the Treasury, but that was my feeling. And so, and people, the Home Office, I came across a little bit. I thought they were slow. I thought they were inefficient. And, you know, these sort of experiences coloured my view of the civil service generally. And so there were stars, of course there were, and still are. There are some competent, hard-working people in the middle. But there are some rather ordinary people who don't, in my humble opinion, earn their keep. And certainly don't take full responsibility. But that wasn't really the question you asked me. The question you asked me was, what did I find different between the civil service and the army? And I think the answer is that I think the army is more flexible on the whole. I think it is more adaptable. I think it is more ready to take responsibility. It's more ready to have original thought. Etc., etc., all the things that go with those sort of statements. And so I think that that's one of the advantages I took into the civil service. With that sort of background, that sort of attitude to life, I think I was going to contribute from the start. And the more I was there, the more I reckon I contributed.
Did you find that you were able to contribute, or that sometimes the civil service characteristics held you in check?
By and large, it wasn't a problem. I did, just before I finished, I did have a female undersecretary who was my immediate boss, who came from the Treasury, and the fact she was a female wasn't a problem. I mean, I can work for a male or a female regardless. But she was a little bit tiresome, I think one would describe it as, a bit pedantic. And I don't think wholly understood what my division, as it then was trying to achieve. But having said that, the people I worked for initially, I found charming, delightful, easy to work with and for, and absolutely not a problem. And I'm thinking of an undersecretary in particular who dealt with Harland and Wolff, with me, and who, when I stumped off, as I can remember, stumping off to some meeting with Shell about two LPGs that they wanted to flog.
LPGs?
Liquid petroleum gas container ships, tankers. And Tony Benn was the industry secretary. I'm sorry, I'm dodging all over the place. Tony Benn was the industry secretary responsible for shipbuilding as a whole. And, of course, I was responsible for Harlan and Wolff, more or less. And I'd been off to talk to Shell about these two ships. And I talked to this particular undersecretary beforehand and said, now, you know, there's a limit to what we can pay. And he said, yes, and we agreed what the figure was to be. And so I stumped off and said to Shell, no, much to their surprise, having argued impassionately for wanting the things. Anyway, eventually, when they produced the price, I said no, and pushed off back to Northern Ireland office. But later that day, Tony Benn, apparently, I never heard directly, but apparently was saying, who's this chap, Karen, who said no to two LPGs from Shell? And so, anyway, they happened in the end, but it's just a silly story. But I think, on the whole, you said something just now about when you were talking about cadets finding it difficult to attune to military discipline and so on, and you mentioned in particular the Guards drill sergeants. Now, I understand to an extent that reluctance on the cadet side, because my background, being a green jacket background, completely and utterly different sort of training from the guardsmen. And so, therefore, instinctively beginning to say, well, look, I wouldn't want to do that either, because I was brought up differently. Having said that, I was chased about from political posts by sergeant majors and sergeants from the moment I joined, which was extremely good for me. And I reckon that green jacket training, the attitude of the individual matters, the individual thinks for himself, all the things that I've grown up with, I found very useful indeed when I went to the civil service, because I was able to apply them. I mean, I went in and I didn't know anything about Harlan and Wolff, I didn't know anything about shipbuilding, but it didn't take me long to learn, and it didn't take me long to find out what I should be doing to help Harlan and Wolff. And to help the Department of Commerce and so on. And, you know, I like to think I learned quickly. And I like to think the reason I learned quickly was because of my military background. And that also helped me to, as it were, encourage others to work quickly and learn quickly and so on. I mean, it's a slightly long-winded way of explaining it all, but it's a subject I'm quite immodest about, actually, because normally, I'm pretty modest in how I approach life and what I blow my own trumpet or not. But as far as entering the civil service and relationships with the civil service and within the civil service are concerned, I reckon I was a good thing.
How did you find dealing with politicians? Because this is something which I think was new to you, wasn't it? Dealing with people like Stanley Orme or indirectly with Wedgwood Benn.
Yes, I did a little bit with outside ministries at the ministerial level, not much. Tony Benn, I think I met. Kaufman, I met when he was industry. But not many others. Our own ministers, I saw very regularly, the industry one in particular, and the Secretary of State to an extent as well. And I think of Merlin Rees, and I think of Roy Mason, I think of the first Conservative who arrived, Atkins, Humphrey Atkins, and I found them all, of whatever party they came from, very easy to deal with. I spoke directly. I didn't hide things. I spoke honestly. And I think they respected that, and I think they understood what I was saying. I think they recognized that I was not trying to hide things. And I think they recognised that I was on their side, because that's what I was paid to be. And Stan Orme, in particular, I wrote to him not long ago, actually, when he got lauded. And I said, I remember vividly when I first came to the Northern Ireland office, my first day going to your briefing on Harland and Wolff and so on, and being told, you know, find out quickly how to do it and so on. And he had a nice letter back from him saying he also remembered that, well, whether he did or not, I have no idea. But he was a very easy chap to deal with. Don Concannon, who succeeded him, was a very, very good minister and a very, very pro-industrial affairs in Northern Ireland, and was a joy to work with and for.
Did you stay in that division the whole time
Yes.
you were in the Northern Ireland
Yes,
office?
I did. I was hired specifically, I think, for that. And in 1978, they very kindly promoted me, and so I got the division as a whole. And that meant that in addition to commerce, manpower and finance, I took on the other things as well. I mean, all the Northern Ireland departments, in fact. In fact, one really would say, and I don't think a number of people in Northern Ireland would be very pleased to hear me say it, but I was more or less responsible for Northern Ireland, less police and prisons. Sorry, the civil government of Northern Ireland, less police and prisons. Nothing to do with security, nothing to do with defence at all. Now, when I say responsible, I was responsible for the Northern Ireland office part of that, which was responsible in turn for dealing with the individual Northern Ireland departments, for dealing with the equivalent departments in Whitehall, and for negotiating from time to time with Brussels. So it was a very wide-ranging responsibility.
What was the main interest of Brussels in Northern Ireland then?
Shipbuilding.
How did they impinge shipbuilding?
And subsidies.
Common transport policy, would that be, or regional policy?
I think... I don't remember getting involved in anything over in Brussels other than competition in terms of subsidies for shipbuilding on the one hand and short aircraft on the other hand. Now, I should have said that at some stage in my first couple of years, the shipbuilding, aircraft and shipbuilding industries bill, which Tony Benn saw through Parliament for the UK less Northern Ireland, GB in fact, Northern Ireland required a similar bill to sort of, as it were, fill Labour Party obligations on the one hand, but also to allow for the fact that Harland and Wolff needed to continue business for political reasons, because it would be awful if it suddenly gave up, but it was bust, and so it had to be taken into the public sector. And so Stan Orme, one of the things, in fact, I had to do with Stan Orme at the beginning was to, you know, produce an order in council to take into public ownership Harland and Wolff on the one hand and Short Brothers on the other hand. Now, they're both now back in private ownership.
Was it generally the case that security considerations or political considerations drove the economic and social policy?
Certainly as far as I was concerned, yes. I mean, I would argue passionately to the Treasury or whoever, and Brussels, that there is no way that you, whoever you was, could afford not to support Harland and Wolff, because there would be absolute chaos if this great jewel in the Northern Ireland crown was allowed to fade away. Now, we all recognise that it was overmanned. We all recognise that its order book was very bad at that time, but it got better. And we all realised that it had to run down its manpower. It was just a question of how quickly that got done. And as I mentioned earlier, I think they were a bit slow. And I think, you know, on reflection, maybe the Northern Ireland office should have pushed a bit harder. it to happen more quickly. But I think in the long run, that would have destroyed relationships with the Department of Commerce, with the Department of Finance, and may well have been counterproductive, and actually would have slowed the whole thing down rather than speed it up. That's a matter of opinion, but I certainly was content with the way we were handling things. I would just like to have seen the Department of Commerce speed things up a bit. But there was a very, very nice gentleman who was the responsible for Harland and Wolff, who I dealt with intimately day by day. I mean, we knew each other very well. But he was a dyed-in-the-wool old civil servant. And, you know, he moved at a certain speed. And his speed, sadly, wasn't quite quick enough for me. But I had to make a choice. I either had to say, right, we'll get rid of him and we'll get somebody else in who will do it better. Or we just held our water and let events take their course rather more slowly. And that's what we did in the end.
Were there prospects of restructuring the Northern Ireland economy at that time? Because in that era, shipbuilding generally was coming under pressure from foreign competition. And
yes,
it was one of the older traditional industries that seemed to be threatened with ultimate extinction.
I think that's right. I think there were one or two companies in Northern Ireland. Mackey's is one that comes to mind, a big engineering company. There were one or two smaller activities. There was various sort of support bodies, some of them for very local and small businesses for support. And I can't remember their exact names now, but their agencies of one sort or another were set up to stimulate business and stimulate industry. One of the things that I think Northern Ireland can complement itself on is its educational arrangements. Schools, on the one hand, where they really, and this was noticeable with the soldiers and their families, say, you know, we actually, our children are being taught the 3 hours, which they weren't necessarily being taught in England.
A more traditional scheme of education.
Yeah, absolutely. And the military families welcome that no end, because they said our children are getting better educated here than they were the other side. And I think the universities, Queen's University on the one hand, Coleraine on the other hand, I think have a very high reputation from all I hear and all I learnt at the time. So those things I think go very well. Restructuring industry, yes.
Did you have positive plans to build a different economy for Northern Ireland in the future? Was there a view derived from political sources of what the Northern Ireland economy should be doing, how it should be developing, what sector should be allowed to decline and waste away, and what sector should be encouraged because they had better long-term prospects?
I think in my time, I can't think of a sort of a review of that sort that reached conclusions of that sort. I don't think so. On the other hand, we all felt the need to support the local economy, to support the local workforce, and to support Harland and Wolff on the one hand, and try and get its order book filled up. And so the work, I think, was intended to try and support those that existed, plus encouraging through these two agencies. One was a large-scale agency and the other was a local agency, encouraging entrepreneur to come along and start new businesses. But to say that, you know, there was a definite policy input to that, I couldn't say yes or no.
Now, Harland Youth was Wolff was under pressure. One way in which governments can sustain shipbuilders is by giving them defence contracts. Was this a possibility for Harland and Wolff?
Sore subject, as far as I'm concerned. It got talked about from time to time, but nothing much happened.